Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this day before the 4th of July, July 3rd, that would make it. In just a moment, we're going to celebrate the 4th of July just a little bit early by rewriting the Constitution of the United States. It's about time, wouldn't you say? A little bit later this hour, a serious topic, documents. Actually, they were 6,000 pages on clergy sexual abuse that were released in Milwaukee on Monday of this week. Chuck Hornbach, who's been following this story for us at WPR, will be talking about the news conference that took place. And Peter Isley will also join us. Peter is the Midwest director of the Survivors Network of those abused by priests and has been working on this issue for a number of years. He was sexually assaulted as a youngster by a Roman Catholic priest in the Archdiocese of Milwaukee. We'll be welcoming your phone calls all hour. And here is how you reach us. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. So those are all ways of you reaching us this afternoon. As we attempt to get our guest online, let me tell you a little bit about him. We're celebrating the 4th of July on July 3rd with an exercise that you may want to engage in. If you're having a cookout tomorrow afternoon, why not have your guests rewrite the Constitution of the United States of America? Kevin Blyer, we hope, will join us shortly. He's author of Me, the People, One Man's Selfless Quest to Rewrite the Constitution of the United States of America. In a blurb recommending the book, historian Doris Kearns Goodwin writes, I knew James Madison. James Madison was a friend of mine. Mr. Blyer, you are no James Madison, but you sure are a heck of a lot more fun. Why a rewrite? Kevin writes, as citizens of the United States of America, you have made a terrible mistake. You've put your faith in a 2 centuries old document written by drunk farmers, scrawled on animal skin, conceived in desperation in the aftermath of war, composed in the language of the country it was intended to spurn, and not for nothing, scribbled in handwriting with the quill of a goose. Kevin is an award-winning writer. He's won the Emmy, actually, not just once, twice, three times, but four times for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. And he has written and produced for both Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher and Dennis Miller. He has contributed also to a number of President Obama's speeches. Actually, there was a guy, and we'll start with this story as soon as we can track down Kevin, who did spend 30 years of his life trying to rewrite the Constitution of the United States. And we'll hear that story and many others. Kevin also says, if the Constitution is such an astonishing document, such a landmark piece of literature, why no Pulitzer? Why no Nobel Prize for this? Hour two of our program today, I do want to tell you, because I think this is one of the best books I haven't finished it. It's a big book, but one of the best, certainly, books of 2013. George Packer will be joining us. The book is The Unwinding, an Inner History of the New America. George is a writer for The New Yorker. And what he does, and he's a beautiful writer, is takes the stories of a number of different people, characters richly drawn, the entrepreneurial son of a failed tobacco farmer, the black daughter of a heroin addict, a young man who really believes early on in Joe Biden and believes that one day he will be president and hitches his wagon to Joe Biden's star and becomes more than slightly disillusioned. There are lots of public figures who are in this book, and they are not entirely flattering portraits of Oprah Winfrey, Sam Walton of Walmart, Newt Gingrich, Colin Powell, and many others. So that is coming up, our number two of our program. And we will try to find Kevin Blyer a little bit later. We may just switch the order of our shows because we can't find Kevin. So we'll have to wait just a little bit longer to celebrate the 4th of July and the 3rd of July. And I hope we'll have a chance to celebrate. Or you may want to think for later this hour about how you would rewrite the Constitution of the United States of America. There, of course, was big news this week concerning clerical sexual abuse last weekend. Archbishop Jerome Listecki from Milwaukee said that readers of the document on clergy sex abuse that was to be released on Monday should be prepared to be shocked. News of the topic can shake one's faith, he said. And Monday, more than 6,000 pages were released. Most of them were being seen for the first time, and they give insight into the role of the Vatican and also local church leaders in priest abuse cases. Among the documents, former Archbishop Timothy Dolan sought Vatican approval to transfer funds. We'll hear what that was all about. And money was paid to abusive priests who agreed to not fight their dismissal from the priesthood. Chuck Hornbach has been following the story for Wisconsin Public Radio. He is joining us in studio a little bit later. Peter Isley will join us, Midwest Director of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, or SNAP. We welcome your phone calls if you've been following this story. We'd like to hear your response to it. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Hello, Chuck. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good afternoon, Kathleen.
Good afternoon to you. So what was released is 6,000 pages. That's a lot of pages. What all was released on Monday?
Well, there were depositions from Archbishop, former Archbishop Weakland, former Archbishop and now New York Cardinal Dolan, Richard Skilba, an associate Archbishop that was Archbishop Weakland's go-to guy on sexual abuse cases. And then there were all these letters and documents written back and forth among the church leaders about the abuse cases, the personnel, some of the personnel files and so on of these abusive priests. So quite a big collection. I don't know if anyone's poured through all 6,000 pages just yet.
Were there any things in the documents that stood out that reporters like you looked at and said, this is big news?
Well certainly, since, as I say, Archbishop Dolan left Milwaukee and went on to become bigger things in New York, New York Cardinal, and then sort of was the face of American Catholic Church during the recent choosing of the new pope. His documents from back in his Milwaukee days caught a lot of attention. This letter to the Vatican asking about the moving of the $57 million from the cemetery fund into a special trust fund for the cemetery to supposedly shield the money from potential claims by the abuse victims. That really caught a lot of attention. And, you know, as Dolan gets bigger, his actions before his time in New York get bigger, too.
And is there some question about whether or not that was legal? Will there be a follow-up on that, Chuck?
Well, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, the SNAP group, and Mr. Isley will explain more in a bit when he's here, you know, has asked the U.S. attorney in Milwaukee to investigate that as potentially being a fraudulent move by Archbishop Dolan at the time, saying you can't, you know, set aside these funds that are supposed to be available for everybody. You can't, in a bankruptcy or fraud case, you can't set them aside to put them in, hide them away, perhaps, as, you know, the critics would say, in the cemetery fund. Now, the archdiocese, which did some media interviews this week, has said, listen, this fund has been around for 100 or so years, money coming from people who bought cemetery plots and expected to have perpetual care at their cemeteries. So it wasn't like some other source of money. This was raised from families, you know, grieving families or families that, you know, set aside their resting place, if you will, that it was okay in the church's mind to say, we want to put this into a trust fund, segregate this, keep it away, and it's right for us to do so. That will be potentially something prosecutors, if they look into the case, will take up. Certainly, potentially something the bankruptcy judge Kelly will continue to explore, and maybe other officials as well.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that people have to pour through the documents, but I would imagine there were a lot of documents relating to a really slow response on the part of the people in the Vatican who were supposed to have an understanding of what was going on here. In some cases, they were alerted to sexual abuse and nothing was done for years.
Well, you might argue that there's thousands of miles between the Vatican and here, and back before the days of email and so on, it was a little slower to communicate. But there's also the argument, of course, that the Vatican just didn't want to deal with some of this or asked was hoping the local officials would sort of keep things under the rug, and because it's a very damaging sort of thing to have these information come out. But through the persistence of the victims, there are very, you know, astute, sharp attorneys who have been pursuing these cases, not just in Milwaukee, of course, but in many locations. The Boston, of course, is the one of the biggest ones, Los Angeles and elsewhere. They know where to look. In other words, the attorneys and the victims are pretty practiced now in knowing where to look and what to pursue and what sort of getting a feel of what the line of communication was. And now through this bankruptcy case, you know, again, this was not the Milwaukee Archdiocese saying, hey, yes, we'll open our files. This was, you know, part of the bankruptcy case where the judge and everyone agreed that these documents will come out, and this date of July 1st was set a couple of months ago in court. So, again, you know sort of where to look at times, but there are still some things in here that were a bit surprising, or that people put them in writing that maybe they regret doing so now.
Mm-hmm. Priests were being paid, would this be an unusual thing, something like $20,000 to leave the priesthood, those who had been accused of sexual misconduct?
Well, there had been reports and suggestions of that before. Maybe the number of payments made, maybe the amounts paid. Again, the Archdiocese argues, listen, we have a canon law, our church law says we must provide for the, not protection, but life mm-hmm. and support, if you will, of the priests until they are no longer part of the church. And so they are saying what they did was justifiable. But it does, the critics would say it has the air of you're paying people to keep quiet and go away quietly, and here's your bonus, get out, you know, leave now before things get too hot.
Mm-hmm. I think this maybe came from former Archbishop Weakland's deposition and perhaps others, which is hard to understand right now, but they say in the context of the times, we just never thought that somebody who abused would go on and abuse again. This was something that we just didn't know very much about, actually, that it was never thought about it being criminal behavior. It was an aberration.
Right. I mean, looking at the press release from the Archdiocese that they put out on Monday afternoon, in general, this is the Archdiocese saying, in general, the documents show some of the following themes. Church leaders and other professionals tried their best to deal with the issue, given the knowledge available at the time. And again, the critics have sort of said, when was abuse of children or others not recognized as a horrible thing? Why are you bringing up this argument again now? I think the church is sort of saying, listen, we're not saying it was a good thing, but they just weren't equipped to deal with things back 20, 30 years ago. But it's putting that out in a July 1st, 2013 press release sets the church back, perhaps, at least in the eyes of the critics.
Do you have any idea, Chuck? We have visitors here from Ireland and Northern Ireland for the month of July, and I've been having some discussions about the impact that this scandal has had on the church in Ireland, and it's been really significant. Church attendance is way, way down. Do you have any idea how the Milwaukee Archdiocese has been affected over the years by this?
Well, it seems that in certain parts of the metro area, and I think they represent 10 counties, I think, it's just more than just Milwaukee, of course, that in certain pockets, certain parts of town, I think their membership is down. There are other parts where I think in some of the Latino neighborhoods, through the voucher schools at least, that church attendance may be up a bit. So it really varies. You know, you hear a lot of anecdotal conversations when you're out with friends
sure.
in the area who grew up in the church who say, I have no intention of going back to this church. But you also hear from Mr. Isley and others in SNAP who often quote church teachings that they learned as they grew up, that you get the sense that some are still quite religious and want to be more tied into the church, but they just will not accept the leadership the way it has done things over the last few decades. And that's really an interesting thing to observe, I guess.
Do you think that after all the church has been through, and I've heard some leaders say this, you would be hard-pressed to find any instances of child sexual abuse now among the clergy because we understand what's happened and it will never happen again?
Well, there have been some cases lately, and again, Mr. Isley may go into detail about this, where there has been some cases. Now, I think it's generally thought that the worst happened 10, 20, 50 years ago, but that doesn't mean that there haven't been some questionable cases of late. It would be almost inconceivable, I suppose, that it would go on now, given the publicity of what went on years ago, but arguments have been made that as long as the church's policy against marriage and a variety of other church policies, marriage of priests, it continues, that there may be problems that continue.
Mm-hmm. And where legally does this, do things go from here? Is there some next step?
Well, I was asking Mr. Isley about that the other day, and it's in the context of the bankruptcy case, and so I think there's going to be more going on back about 8 blocks east of here in the federal courthouse. But I've talked, with legal experts over the last couple of years who have said that bankruptcy court is not the greatest place to deal with sexual abuse cases. It's sort of, you're introducing all these potential criminal acts into what is often what are your assets, and mm-hmm. there's crimes in bankruptcy too, but it's often more financial discussion, and Judge Kelly has tried to deal with this, but you see her at times on the bench where she's getting these strong arguments from the church's lawyers and from the victim's lawyers and the other creditors' lawyers, where it's just very strong arguments, and she's like, what do I do? And she's trying to sort of a middle ground where she doesn't want to block the good work of the church, but recognizes the awful things that happened to some of these victims. And now she'll get this release out. I'm not sure when the next hearing date is, but we're 2.5 years into this bankruptcy case in Milwaukee now. One of the longer church abuse victim-related bankruptcies that have gone on, maybe the longest, but at least one of the longest, and I'm not sure it's quite over yet. Or will we, I'm holding up the newspaper from the other day, will the ongoing pictures of 45 people that made the front page, 45 clergy members, will that affect sort of a change in the church's attitude, and will it push them closer to some sort of settlement? We haven't heard any talk of any settlement, but settlements have occurred elsewhere, so...
Do you have any idea how much money has been spent on this on the part of the church in terms of lawyers' fees, et cetera?
Well, I think some of the figures that have come out this year suggest that in the bankruptcy case, it's $7, $8 million. That seems like a large sum, of course, but when we are talking settlements that could range much more than that, perhaps... The church is saying, well, we'll write off $8 million, and if we win, we'll save a lot of money. But if they lose, then they're going to have these payments to the lawyers plus payments to the victims as well. It's a bit of a gamble, and it's the money's coming from somewhere.
Yeah. Thank you, Chuck, very much. Thanks. Chuck Kornbach following the story for us for Wisconsin Public Radio. Peter Isley will be joining us momentarily. Peter has been Midwest Director of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, or SNAP, for a long time. We do want to tell you we contacted the Milwaukee Archdiocese, and Archbishop Listecki was unavailable to be on this program. We'll keep asking and would like to hear from the Archdiocese at some point. Peter will join us momentarily, and we'll welcome your phone calls. Did anything shock you by the release of those 6,000 documents on Monday? Has your faith in the church diminished because of this scandal, or do you believe that it can continue its mission of helping people and serving the poor and doing the work of the Lord on earth, or has this rocked the church in ways that it will be difficult for it to recover? We certainly welcome your thoughts on all of this, and here's how you reach us. like to hear from you. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. You can leave messages in any of those places. Peter Isley joining us momentarily. And we hope that you will as well. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Peter Isley is joining us now to talk about the documents that were released, 6,000 pages released, most being seen for the first time on Monday. Peter has been working on this issue for a long time. He is the Midwest Director of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, or SNAP. He was sexually abused as a youngster by a Roman Catholic priest in the Archdiocese of Milwaukee. He's a psychotherapist in private practice who directed the nation's only inpatient treatment program for clergy sexual abuse trauma, and he's a graduate of the Harvard Divinity School. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Peter. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Peter, thank you so much for being with us. Hello.
Hello, thank you.
So was there anything shocking? The Archbishop said we should be prepared to be shocked by the release of these documents. You've been working on this for years and years. Did anything shock you?
Well, you know, this may come as a surprise, but what kind of shocked me the most is that the day that these documents were released is that Archbishop Listecki was nowhere to be found. And that was shocking to me, because as the pastor of the Milwaukee Archdiocese, that was the day that he really needed to show up. I think it was his most important day as the Archbishop of Milwaukee, and he wasn't there. And that shocked me. I mean, everything that I saw in these documents, I knew was there, more or less. I lived through it. I got an email today. I'm getting a lot of emails today, but I got one that really touched me, of a man who said, I've always disagreed with you. I don't like you, and I haven't liked you until I saw these documents. Now I understand. I completely support what you and others have been trying to do.
That person didn't believe you?
He didn't like that we were challenging the church. You know, before I came on, we were talking a little bit, and I was telling you how 19 years ago when my son was born, it was the month my son was born, I was on your program talking about this. I mean, this is incredible.
19 years ago.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I tell people, however, that we've made more progress in 19 years than in 19 centuries on this issue. The problem is, as someone told me, that it, every year feels like a century.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, we've had made tremendous progress. And yesterday was a historic, or 2 days ago was a historic day for survivors and others in this community.
Mm-hmm.
The dedication of the victim survivors and their families to the truth is so inspiring. And especially these survivors, like the men and women from St. John's School for the Deaf, which is the most... No, they're all
egregious.
Horrible.
They are horrible, but that one is really awful.
And they came forward publicly about this. The first survivors ever in the world that we know of to do that in the 1970s. And they're still at it. Some of these survivors are still trying to get some kind of help and restitution from the Archdiocese, and they're fighting their claims in court right now.
Mm-hmm. What happened to you, Peter?
I was sexually assaulted when I was a youngster. I was 13 to 14, and I was attending St. Lawrence Seminary, which was a boarding school. It still operates. It's a boarding school run by the Capuchin Franciscan priests. And the man who assaulted me was Father Gail Liefeld. Father Liefeld was the rector of the school. We now know he had a history of sexually assaulting and abusing youngsters at the school for 35, 40 years.
40 years?
Yeah. And he was repeatedly kept in that position. He was promoted. This is a place that is in rural Wisconsin. It's in the middle of nowhere. Appropriately called the village of Mount Calvary. And... you know, there's a lot of wonderful things that happened in that school as well. I mean, it was a very unusual experience to go to a boarding school. I was to be a priest. There were eight in my family, eight kids in my family. I had a twin brother as well. My oldest brother was 13, and I was 9 months old, and my father died in a car crash.
Mm.
My mother had to raise all of us by herself. And we lived in Fond du Lac, and St. Joseph's Parish in Fond du Lac was our parish. And that was our life, was that parish. My mother went to Mass every single day of her life. She died a few years ago on St. Patrick's Day, appropriately. I think it was to get back at her mother-in-law, her Irish mother-in-law, to die on St. Patrick's Day. My mother's Croatian, full Croatian. So you can see I got a Croatian grandparents and Irish. That's a pretty combustible combination.
You're a fiery guy.
Yeah, there's Swiss in there too, though. That puts the reasoning in there and a little bit of cold, common sense. But she went to Mass every day of her life, and she was a completely dedicated Catholic. And she so loved her faith and her church. And the Father Liefeld, when he would assault me afterwards, he would say, your mother, if your mother ever finds out about what you're doing to me, these offenders are so smart, they're so clever, especially these offenders. They're high functioning. They all have graduate degrees. Every single picture up there of those priests.
All those priests.
All of them have graduate degrees. These are all individual. Think about this. They are charming. They are speaking to hundreds and hundreds of people a week, giving homilies, and they're in at people at the most vulnerable times of their life, and counseling, and they're loved and respected. This is the top of the batting order when it comes to, people in our community that are educated and respected. This is a very, very high-functioning, highly manipulative group of child sex offenders.
So did you keep it quiet, Peter? Did you talk to your mom or not?
I eventually did, and I started dealing with this in my mid to late 20s. I went back to the Capuchin Order and told them what had happened, the provincial, hoping that they would do something about it. They promised they would. They didn't. Father Liefeld was transferred out of St. Lawrence and to Milwaukee. He was at Sacred Heart Seminary then. He was living unsupervised. He was at St. Robert's Church in Shorewood, working all the time. In fact, I know the pastor who was there at the time. He's a friend of mine now. And He told me how great Liefeld was, and he needed his help, and he was helping him out, and he had asked the Archdiocese, could you make him the co-pastor, one of the co-pastors, because he's so good. And then he said he disappeared. And, of course, now he found out later on it was because he was a child molester. And the Archbishop had put, and this is a thing about priests in this Archdiocese, so many good guys, dedicated, they've dedicated their entire life to trying to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. There's a group of us, of clergy and survivors, that have been meeting together now for several years. We're formalizing ourselves, the Survivor Clergy Alliance. You can see Father Jim Connell with us at press conferences,
yes,
as a vice chancellor. But these priests have really been betrayed. It's not just victims and their families. But imagine this, that you've got this priest who they know is a child molester, and you're not being told this, and he's getting complete access to your congregation. So there's just so much damage that's been done, and it's not over with yet. The truth has not completely been told. There are offenders, known offenders in this archdiocese who are like Capuchins, like Jesuits. Father Liefeld's file, I have his file, but that wasn't released, even though he spent his entire ministry in the Archdiocese of Milwaukee under the permission of this archbishop. And so, because he's a Capuchin, it's ridiculous. People need to know every single person that has sexually molested or assaulted a child, a cleric, a nun, a brother, a teacher, that they know about down at the Archdiocese. And I can guarantee you there are dozens that they know about that they have not released the information about. And we need to know who they are and where they are, who's watching them, what's going on with them. And to say, well, he's a Jesuit, Well, you know, so what? I mean, there was a priest in Wauwatosa, Father Marcicek, recently removed from ministry for recent reports with children spanning from 2005 to 2011. Now we know he had reports in California before he was transferred here and executed in that assignment by Cardinal Dolan, now Cardinal Dolan. He had, there's victims from Green Bay before he went to California. We're talking like a 35-year period. So we, and this is now, this is happening now. Did you see his file?
No.
No.
Let's go to phone calls. Peter Isley is with us. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. We did contact the Milwaukee Archdiocese for this show. Archbishop Listecki was unavailable. We hope that that will change, and he's welcome, or somebody from the Archdiocese is welcome to be on the air with us. Kim in Milwaukee, our first caller for you, Peter. Hi, Kim.
Hi. My question is, I was a former Catholic, my husband and I, and because of all this, we have just been so disgusted with the Catholic Church because of this. My first question would be, why aren't these priests, why haven't they ever been prosecuted like what regular people would be if any one of us would be molesting children? Why aren't these people being prosecuted? Just like what he said, these are these people put priests up on a pedestal, and these are counselors. These are people that are highly trained to help people. We're supposed to go to priests when we have issues. They took advantage of all of these young men and women, and they're just on their merry way. They, you know, either got transferred to another church, or they, you know, got disembowelished, and now they're whatever they're doing, car salesmen up north doing whatever. They're living their lives however they want to live their life.
Peter.
Well, I mean, that's the number one question that is always asked. It was being asked 19 years ago, sitting in this chair. Part of it is the statute of limitations on child sex crimes. Traditionally and historically, it's been terrible. It's been like 6 years. So if you're assaulted when you were five, you only have until you're whatever, you know, 11 to report it to the police. And so that's why most of these crimes are never reported. That statute's changed. It's improved considerably. But you're stuck with the statute at the time the crime took place. So a lot of these crimes that were known about, the Archdiocese covered them up and hid them in order to get past the statute of limitations, criminal statute of limitations. Some of these individuals have been prosecuted in recent times. There's been 22 clergy that have been prosecuted in Wisconsin over the last few years because prosecutors are now prosecuting them.
Right.
But you know the bottom line is, and her question is important, and it gets raised the most, is what's the difference? Why does this organization, you know, religious institutions seem to evade the law when it comes to these sorts of crimes? And you know, I can just tell you in my long experience that the churches are a big economic function in this state. For instance, they're a political organization as well. I mean, Archbishop Listecki wrote a column today about the document release for the Catholic, I think, newspaper. But his point was, it's all about secularism. You know, like there's an attack on the church because of our stand on, I don't know, birth control or fighting, you know, gay marriage. And it's ridiculous. The thing is, look, there are now 6,100 clergy that have been known, admitted by the American bishops, to have sexually assaulted children over the past decades in the United States. 6,100. They have been moved from parish to parish. They were moved across state lines, across international boundaries. The Justice Department, our Justice Department, has never investigated this, ever. Do you know of a single congressional hearing on this in the last 19 years? Not one. So there's so much politics involved in this. It's a large, important institution, and it does a tremendous amount of good work, but it's like the third rail of politics. They just don't want to get involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, religion can be a very good thing, but I see it as a ethically neutral instrument. It depends on who picks it up, who picks up those symbols, and who picks up that tradition. We want to think that religion can make bad people good, and it can, or it can keep good people good. What's hard for some people to realize is that it can also make good people do bad things. In the most extreme example, it can make people fly planes into buildings. And they do it in the name of God and Jesus. I bet you that Archbishop Weakland or Bishop Scalba never, ever would have done the things they did, cover up for these crimes, if it wasn't for their religion. They never would have done it. And they did it for their religion.
Thanks very much for the call. It is incredible, we were talking to Chuck about this, that you hear the line with the release of these documents, we just didn't know many years ago that these priests would reoffend. We didn't know how serious this was. Essentially, they were saying, we didn't know what this was, which is hard to understand. Doesn't everybody know that sexually abusing a child, haven't we known that for ages, forever, that it's wrong?
Of course, it's not true. You really don't need to understand this. It's simply not true, this claim. It was interesting. Way back in 1992, the American Psychological Association of Wisconsin, the Offender Treatment Unit, or Offender Treatment Group, wrote an open letter to Weakland, and there's a story in the newspaper, I just found it yesterday, saying that what you're doing with these offenders, what you're claiming, you know, that treatment people were telling you to do this or somehow, is complete nonsense. We've known as treatment people, offender treatment people, since at least the early 1970s that you have to treat this, but they cannot be around children. They cannot be put in occupations with children. When Weakland first got here, he had a Father Wadera, was already convicted and in prison or on probation. When he got here, he had someone with a sexual assault conviction. He put him in Delafield, where he assaulted again. Then they covered up his crime. And in that log, when you look at his file, and I can't, you know, I don't want to upset some of your listeners, but look, you know, Father Wadera was having second, third graders urinate in his mouth before he, seriously, this is what I'm talking about. So he knew all this. Weakland knew all this when he got here about this man. He puts him somewhere else. He gets caught at it again, but he's still on probation. So he's got to keep him on ice. And you can see in the file, they bring in Father Wadera, and he admits it, and they tell him, the archdiocese, the vicar of priests, we're going to keep a lid on this. That's a quote written down, you know, typed, we're going to keep a lid on this so the police won't find out about it. And then they dispatch somebody to go deal with the mother. It's a single mother and her child. She's concerned about the parish, according to the file. She's concerned they're going to turn on her. They find out about this. So they go down to keep her quiet, shut her up. Move Wadera then gets to go to California, assault more children in California, et cetera, on and on it goes. So there's your so-called, I don't know, we didn't know. And by the way, it was always a crime. It was always, always, always a crime under Wisconsin law and like every other law across the planet.
And Glenn in Cedarburg. Hi, Glenn.
Hello. I think your guest has made some fantastic points and stole my thunder. I guess my question is, wasn't the hierarchy when these allegations are brought, aren't they duty bound to call the police?
His phone was kind of
right,
scratchy.
Right, sure. Aren't they duty bound to call? Mm-hmm. Well, by conscience, you're supposed to call the police. But let me tell you the fix with this organization, you know, with some, I don't know how to say it, with the politics in Wisconsin around this. There's a reporting law. 28 professions are required, mandated, and have been for decades to report child sexual abuse. You know what the reporting law in Wisconsin? First of all, clergy didn't have to report until 2002 when this scandal broke again. They rewrote the law. Wisconsin lawmakers, both sides, rewrote the law. Clergy now have to report, except there's an exemption written into the law. A clergy person doesn't have to report child sexual rape if they find out about it in the course of their pastoral duties. Or, listen to this. This is written into law. The tenets, tradition, and practices of their church require them to keep it secret. I am not kidding. That is one, pastoral duties or whatever, that means, like, I'm a social worker. I have to report child sexual abuse unless I find out about it as a social worker. And then if my religious tradition, which is exactly what Archbishop Lustecki and these bishops have argued in court, that the relationship between a bishop and his priest is like a lawyer, it's totally privileged and secret. No one can ask questions about it. So there you go. So under no circumstances in the state of Wisconsin right now whatsoever does a bishop or a clergy person or any of these religious denominations have to report child sexual abuse. The law is virtually telling them not to do it.
Peter Isley is our guest. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8653. 855 is the number. Peter is the Midwest director of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, or SNAP. You'll recall that on Monday of this week, Milwaukee Archbishop Jerome Listecki released a lot of documents, 6,000 pages relating to sexual abuse of children by priests. And we're talking about the enormity of this and what it means for the church and what it means for the victims and what it means for the future. More phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, George Packer will be joining us. George is a writer for The New Yorker, and his book is, I highly recommend it. It's beautifully written. It centers on what he calls the unwinding of America in inner history of the new America. He concentrates on a number of characters, some not very well known, others like Joe Biden, Oprah Winfrey, Colin Powell, more well known. It'll be worth listening to, and it's definitely worth reading. Peter Isley is our guest. Peter, what do the victims want at this point? Where are you going from here?
Our first concern is always public safety. So we want the Archdiocese and all the religious orders here to cough up the rest of the files and names of these known abusers. That's number one. And so if I know that there are 10 child molesters in the neighborhood and I'm going to tell you about five of them, that's not sufficient. So that's our number one priority right now. And that's going to be argued in court about these other offenders and religious orders. So that's the most important thing.
When is that going to be argued?
Probably in the next few weeks and months. Okay. I mean, this bankruptcy has been going on for 2.5 years. All they have done is fight every single claim in court. There's 570 victims that came forward. Those are all criminal complaints as well, by the way. And they're all under seal. And there's a lot of alleged offenders in there that are not on this 45 list that need to be investigated and determined whether they committed these crimes, because most of them did, and they have to be removed from ministry. I mean, there's such a massive amount of work that still needs to be done here. But, you know, our first concern, I can't say it enough, is public safety. That's the first concern. And then secondly, stop fighting these claims and come to a resolution for some kind of restitution. I mean, one of the things that we found out in these documents, and the most important thing for, I think, Catholicism in the United States as an institution, is Cardinal Dolan's involvement in these cases when he was here. First of all, he paid off known child sex offender priests so they could quietly leave the priesthood, get themselves new lives and careers. And the Archdiocese paid for this, by the way. Catholic charitable money paid for, like, Father Jerome Wagner, who's now a grief counselor. He got himself recertified as a grief counselor. He's running a ministry in a funeral home in Fond du Lac with families. That's what he gets to do. Father Massey's a social worker now at a clinic in Beaver Dam. Father Neuberger, whose case is, read his file, it is unbelievable. Father Neuberger, where was he yesterday? He was tutoring at the Y over on the east side. That, if you think, you know, that this is finished, just end. Now, listen to this. They were paid before they left. They were given an education, resume writing. They were helped to remake themselves into, in these cases, careers so they could work again with families. And then Dolan, to sweeten the pot, paid them $20,000 each. Besides the pension, they're also going to get $20,000, just a check, to sign the final papers to make it easier for him to deal with getting it to the Vatican. And that was like it's like $10,000 at the beginning of doing the paperwork and $10,000 at the end. It's like a heroin deal in some back alley.
What should he have done?
He should have done he should have named all of them and got their complete record out in public right away, just like any responsible occupation does in this state. If there's a social worker or a therapist or a teacher or somebody that has assaulted a child, the board rules on that. That is available to everybody. License revoked, period, done for. You know exactly the details of the case. So he should have done that. He should have made public notification at all the parishes in the communities where these individuals serve. And this is most important. He should have, instead of paying them off dirty money, he should have got on a plane to Rome and used his I spent a lot of time with Dolan. When he's in a room, you know he's there. That's what I'm saying. No one says, hey, does anyone see our Cardinal Timothy? Is he coming into the room yet? He could have gone over to Rome and said, look, this is broken. There is something wrong with this system. We've got to fix it.
All right, let's go to phone calls. We have tons of them. Rick in Monona, hi.
Hi. I appreciate your information. I had never thought about the political complicity in this before. I had two questions. One of them is, do you think that this goes all the way to the Vatican? I can't imagine that they kept this isolated and that just the American bishops and cardinals knew that this was going on. I'm wondering if you have an opinion about the Vatican being involved and knowing that this was going on and these and to keep it quiet.
Yeah, I better an opinion. I got facts. And you can go to those documents. You can see that. First of all, I'd invite people to go to our website, SNAP Network, snapnetwork.com, and you'll see not just these documents, but all of our information about offenders in this community and so forth. It's an excellent website. But, of course, the Vatican knew about this. In the case we talked about with Father Murphy, it was Cardinal Ratzinger who left him, ruled to leave him in ministry after they had determined he had assaulted 200 deaf children. So he's left to be a priest and left in ministry. And all the deaf community want here, these victims at the time, this is like 97, was please when he dies, at least when he dies, don't bury him as a priest. So what do you think happened? Not only did he get buried as a priest, he got buried in full vestments. Bishop Scalba did the funeral mass. Open casket, gold vestments. If you go to his grave now, it's Reverend Lawrence Murphy on his grave. The Vatican has been involved in many, many of these cases. This is a hierarchy, and no priest can be fired or removed without the permission of the Pope. This Neuberger fellow, this guy who's at the YMCA, he's been known about as a child sex offender. Look at his file. For over 25 years, Rome has yet to remove him from the priesthood. He's technically still a priest. So, of course, the responsibility goes directly to the top. The evidence now shows it goes to the top. There's something I just have to say that I'm most proud of in this file, these files. There's a line in there where Cardinal Dolan is writing Ratzinger, he's going to be Pope, about one of these cases. And he says, the victims are getting so good at organizing that it threatens a real scandal is going to take place. And this is like 2004. So up to that point, the real scandal hadn't happened yet. But it really is a testament to how victims and survivors organizing and pressing for change and truth has really shaken the entire foundation of this criminal activity within the Catholic Church.
Those who are supportive of Dolan have said that he has been outspoken talking about what a horrible sin this has been and that he has talked about some priests and reported some priests, and the Vatican just took years to do anything about it.
What he did is he paid off priests. Archbishop Weakland, he paid $500,000 to cover up something he did. Dolan wasn't here 6 months. He does the same thing. He's paying off the what's interesting, too, about these documents that has been covered in the national press, of course, is about Dolan transferring $55 million
and then
declaring bankruptcy. And that, you know, again, it's like if anybody else did that, and he said in the letter to the Vatican to get permission to do this, why he's doing it. It's in order to shield this money away from liability because of these sex abuse cases. So you can't take, you set up a bogus corporation. It's one trustee, by the way. It's the Archbishop. It's Listecki who runs the cemetery trust. That money was in the regular books. And you take $55 million, you put it up in a dummy corporation, and then you go to the federal court and you say, we don't have this money. We don't declare this money. That's fraudulent transfer, as far as I can. It's fraudulent conveyance. And the statute of limitation is still good on this. He's saying the intent. So we're hoping, of course, logically, there's going to be a federal investigation into the transfer of money. But whether it's concealing money, concealing sex offenders, because money and crime goes together in any organization, we're simply not at the bottom of this.
Thanks very much for the call. We have about 30 seconds left. Is this such an overriding issue for you that you feel that the church can do nothing good now, or do you think that it can be redeemed and there is a lot of good being done in the church?
You know, the church does an immense amount of good. I'm working closely with, you know, several clergy in this archdiocese. They're great guys. You know, I'll put it this way. Catholics sometimes, they get upset, understandably. They feel they're being attacked, and they're not. But, you know, they always tell me, this hasn't made me lose my faith. And I always say to them, well, it's good you've succeeded where Christ failed, because Christ lost his faith. And what he didn't lose, and he lost his faith on the cross, and he cried out that loss of faith. It's not a problem to lose your faith and be a Christian or be a Catholic.
Peter, thank you so much for being with us. Peter Isley, our guest. He is with SNAP, founding member and longtime Midwest director of SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. We will eventually find somebody from the Milwaukee Archdiocese who will join our conversation. We contacted Archbishop Listecki's office for today and was told that he was unavailable, but we'll keep working on it. Thanks to KP Whaley and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thank you, everybody, for your calls. We have news coming up momentarily, and we'll be talking about the unwinding of America, the second hour of our program.